Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In this country, transracial adoptions usually involve white parents adopting children from another race. The practice was pretty rare up until the 1970s when it became more accepted. And now, with this early generation of transracial adoptees well into adulthood, they're starting to share their experiences. What it was like growing up Asian or African American with white parents. It's a deep and complicated subject, one tackled recently by NHPR's Word of Mouth team with an episode told more from the adult adoptee's perspective called Love When Love Isn't Enough. Today in The Exchange, we pick up on that work as we explore transracial adoption in the Granite State, and we definitely want your stories and your questions. So let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us from the West Coast is Angela Tucker, a transracial adoptee who runs the website The Adopted Life, which features conversations with adoptees about their experiences. Also, it includes Angela's documentary, Closure, on the story of the search for her birth parents. Angela joins us from Washington State. Angela, it's great to have you. Thank you for getting up early.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Also with us in studio, Angie Lane. Angie was adopted as an infant from South Korea. She grew up in New Hampshire. Today, she's executive director of Red River Theaters in Concord. And Angie, welcome back. It's really good to see you.
Yeah, thank you, Laura.
And also with us, Kelly Smith, a longtime social worker for foster and adoptive families in New Hampshire. Kelly specializes in attachment, trauma, and loss, and she teaches the course for all New Hampshire families who are adopting privately. And Kelly, welcome back. It's good to see you, too.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us is Jimmy Gutierrez. Again, he produced that episode that I mentioned, When Love Isn't Enough. We've got a link on our website if you want to check it out, nhpr.org/exchange. And Jimmy, just real quick, what drew your interest to this story?
Yeah, so we were, it was a colleague of ours reporting on North Conway. It was two black teen boys who were being, just a lifetime of being bullied and being exposed to, like, racial epithets. And it wasn't the focal point of the story, but we were talking, her and I, while she was doing the reporting, that they were having these experiences, and it seemed like the school had no real idea how to respond. Their family didn't really know how to respond, and that's when we kind of found out that they were transracial adoptees. They were black children adopted by white parents. And so this idea of, like, racism was kind of, like, foreign to them until it kind of, like, struck their children, and it kind of crystallized, like, over years and years and years. So it was kind of like, well, let's lean into this. What does this mean now?
So the school struggled to figure it out, to help them out. The parents themselves had a struggle, Jimmy, trying to, you know, because they didn't grow up in this system.
Exactly. Yeah, it was, this foreign thing. So you hear these stories, but until you deal with microaggressions every day, until you have to, you know, what do you do as a five-year-old being called, you know, certain names, you know, that those are experiences that are just foreign to people that just aren't black or of color or from a different background.
So every reporter learns something from doing their work. What did you learn, Jimmy, in the process of doing this piece on transracial adoption that kind of made you say, wow, I never thought about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's really that when it comes, like, one, I learned that this is not just in Conway. From reporting that I've done in Concord, on the seacoast, like, this is something that happens everywhere. There are just low numbers of children of color. There are not a lot of people of color in administrative positions within schools, and so the responses to these situations are also lacking and just not really thorough or address any issues in any sort of a deep way. But also that when these conversations happen, It usually never centers the adoptee's voice. We always talk about the parents' voice. What do the parents need? Instead of listening to the adoptees, like, hey, what would be helpful here? And so that was something that we also tried to address on our show.
It's a slightly different take. Yeah,
exactly.
Usually it's from a parental perspective, which is totally legit. But this is interesting because, as I said in the introduction, this became more common in the 70s and 80s, and now if you were adopted as a child in the 70s and 80s, you know, you're 30, 40 years old. So
right,
starting
to
share your story. What sort of reaction have you received from listeners, Jimmy, about this episode?
So, which was actually interesting. There was not a lot of critique. What I heard more of was from the adoptees, transracial adoptees in particular. And it was very affirming, I think, just to have them have a platform for their own stories, not really overshadowed by parents talking about what their experiences should be like, that they should be grateful for this experience, just like a space to be honest about what it was like growing up in a majority white space in this kind of way.
Right.
So it was just, I think, a very affirming experience.
Well, and our other guests will definitely talk about that for the rest of the hour. Jimmy, we'll let you go. We really appreciate you being with us.
All right. Thank you, Laura.
That's NHPR producer Jimmy Gutierrez. Again, he recently reported on the conversation among adult transracial adoptees in an episode called When Love Isn't Enough. We've got a link on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And we'd love to hear from you on this topic. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Well, Angie, Kelly, and Angela, I want to hear from all of you on some of what Jimmy shared with us. But Angela, to you first, please, just give us the basic outline of your own personal narrative.
I was adopted as an infant from the state of Tennessee and then grew up in Bellingham, Washington, which is up in the northwest corner of the state, really close to Canada. My parents adopted a lot of kids of color, and they are white. And I grew up feeling kind of like a token. There were a lot of stereotypes, but my parents were really open about having conversations about race, and that was really helpful to me to make sense of my own story. When I grew up and was able to start searching for my birth parents, I did that. So at the age of 26, I found my birth parents and flew to the South, traveled with my family, which was really interesting, and my husband, who is white, to meet my Black family. And there were moments of embarrassment, you know, in the understanding that I wasn't like them. And some transracial adoptees term this kind of as feeling like we're not Black enough, but we're also not white. And so where do we fit? And so my life kind of, I grew up with that dichotomy. And now in my work, I really want to give space for adoptees to explain that really unique position.
It is unique, yeah. And I've heard or read from other transracial adoptees that feeling of, I'm not white enough, I'm not Black enough, where do I fit in? And so that seems like, Angela, that inspired your work to set up these places for transracial adoptees to share.
Yes, exactly.
In your writing and your work too, Angela, you've said that one of the major struggles of transracial adoptees, and again, this seems to form the backbone of your work, is an inability to speak truthfully about their feelings without hurting, upsetting, betraying their adoptive parents. How did you go about that, Angela? You know, speaking the truth that your experience wasn't all, you know, roses without wounding those parents who loved you and raised you.
Well, I'm grateful that my parents didn't share that hurt with me that so often adoptive parents do kind of unwittingly. They don't understand that by talking about how they came to adopt their children, and sometimes it comes with like a lot of tears and emotions from the adoptive parent's side that like, it took so long for us to adopt you, we waited for you for so long. Many adoptive parents weave in their own story of infertility or things like that, that serves to make the adoptee really fearful of sharing their truth because we don't want to hurt our adoptive parents anymore.
Because you understand their struggle, yeah.
Yeah, and to hurt them anymore would risk another kind of feeling of abandonment. And so instead, a lot of adoptees choose to just be silent. I didn't have that. And in fact, I didn't know that my mom feared being replaced by my birth mom. She stated that exact thing in the documentary about my search. I didn't even know she felt that until I saw it on the movie. And that, I think, really helped me because I didn't have to fear that my parents would be hurt by me searching for my birth parents. So I was really able to have these conversations my whole life, and that understanding that that's unique, I've wanted to leverage that and know that I can speak about my experience without my parents feeling hurt by it.
You know, I want to turn to you too, Angie Lane. And as I said in the beginning, you were adopted as an infant from South Korea, grew up in New Hampshire. What are your thoughts on what Angela says that, you know, you want to speak truthfully that, you know, maybe you had a great childhood, but it wasn't always easy, given that you grew up in a white family in a largely white community. You want to speak that truth. You want to share the experience, but you don't want to hurt your parents.
I relate greatly to that experience. I had a overall very great childhood, and I think that I definitely felt that guilt. I certainly didn't want my parents to feel that I didn't love them or that I didn't feel that they were my parents. And so it's really hard to, especially as a child, when you're just trying to figure that out in your mind, you have these feelings, but you don't necessarily want, you know, though, that it could be hurtful. So you keep them to yourself. So I relate to that greatly. And I didn't necessarily know until an adult that other adoptees felt that way. So it felt very isolating because you feel like it, and you embed that into yourself. Like I'm a terrible person. Like I'm feeling ungrateful or, you know, maybe they're going to take that I don't love them as much as I truly do, but you still have these coexisting feelings. And
yeah, so I do love you. I appreciate you,
yes.
But I need to talk about this.
Yeah, and as a child, it's really hard to figure that out in your brain because you know you're feeling these things, but you can't articulate them in the way that you feel is, I mean, not even as an adult, it's hard. So, you know,
Angela shared, Angie, some of her the way her parents talked about, you know, this racial issue in their family early on. What about you? What are some early memories of conversations with your parents when you were little about what it meant to look differently from them?
It's so hard because I have memories of being given books about being adopted, being told that I'm special, that they, you know, chose me. You know, a running joke is I have two older brothers who are not adopted and, you know, they chose me, you know, they put all this work and effort for me and, you know, they just did the old natural way for my brothers. But so I didn't really get a lot of conversations, though, about being of a different race. And so for me, it was hard and it was something I struggled with as a child far into my teenage and 20s, you know, trying to figure out my racial identity in the context of, you know, growing up here in New Hampshire. So I don't necessarily have specific memories about being spoken to about being a different race.
So they didn't really talk to you about that?
You know, if it came up, I think it was more about just that, oh, you know, it's fine. You know, if people are making fun of you, oh, you're beautiful. Like, we love you. And so, well, all great intentions there, but I think they struggled with the idea of what it meant to be of color in a vastly white community. And for a while, I didn't have any other person of color until maybe elementary school. But all I knew that as I was different and that it was for me a negative thing. And even though, you know, parents can love you no matter, you know, and give you all of that support. But when you're in school and you're being made fun of.
Oh, yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, and kids are asking, like, why your skin is that way or why your eyes are that way. So as a child, it's really hard to figure out, you know, for me, I was like, yeah, why do I look this way? And for my parents, they just didn't, you know, for the fact that I was their daughter, they didn't necessarily know how to answer those questions for me, but just tried to support and love me. And so I think that's wonderful. And that got me through all of those struggles, but at the same time didn't answer the questions that I was confronted with constantly. So I had to fill in the blanks a lot on my own.
Wow. And when a kid fills in the blanks, sometimes that's helpful and sometimes it isn't. So I want to ask you and Angela in a minute, sort of how parents helped you or didn't help you navigate some of the playground teasing and so forth. But Kelly Smith, to bring you into this as well, you work with families in New Hampshire. What trends have you seen in transracial adoption in this state?
There definitely has been an increase in transracial adoption. I've been doing this for about 30 years now, and clearly there's an increase. We had probably 5 years ago, we had many, many families that were adopting children from Ethiopia. Prior to that, we had children coming home to New Hampshire from Guatemala. Now we're looking at children from Colombia and South Korea. So clearly there are children coming in from all over the world into New Hampshire and our own New Hampshire families that are choosing adoption for their children, and some of those children are biracial or African-American.
Well, I got an email from Judith in Hopkinton who says, in the intro to your program on transracial adoption, you presented this as being when white families adopt Asian or African-American children. Judith says, this is unfortunately a culturally biased approach. Black and Asian families also adopt or foster parents to white children. I have close friends who are from Central Africa and who for many years were foster parents in New Hampshire. Some of the children they very successfully fostered were white or Asian. It would be important to make clear, Judith says, that adoption and fostering are not just things done by white people. Fair point, Judith. I did say usually involves white parents. I did not say always involves white parents. But in New Hampshire, I'm guessing, Kelly, it's mostly white parents.
Correct. That's been my experience. And the seminar that I teach it about every 6 weeks for families who are in the process of adopting a child. 98% of those families in the room are Caucasian families.
98% of families in the room.
Maybe 99.
And again, you teach the adoption class that all private adoptions, families doing private adoptions have to work through.
Correct. In the state of New Hampshire, it's a part of the Child Placing Agency rules for a child to be adopted privately, that the parents need to experience some education prior to bringing that child home. It's part of the home study process.
How nervous are the parents that you work with about adopting across racial lines?
Some of them are very aware of it and are nervous. Some of them don't even know to be nervous because they're not even thinking about it. And the seminar that I teach is for some of the parents is eye-opening, like, oh my gosh, I have to start thinking about this. And yes, you kind of do need to start thinking about this and really thinking about not just them as a couple or an individual, but their community, their school district, grandma and grandpas and aunts and uncles who live in other places around the state or country. So it really, for some of the families, it's the first time they thought about having to think about this.
The number again for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email like Judith did. Judith, thank you very much. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Angela, I'd love your thoughts on some of the things we've been talking about. It's so interesting. One of the things that Angie said that I wanted to ask you about, Angela, is this language that adoptees are sometimes presented by from their very well-meaning parents. We chose you. I don't think it was you, but maybe somebody on your blog who wrote, okay, that kind of feels like shopping. You know, I'm choosing this cereal over that cereal. So what do you think about that, Angela?
It's really complex, and I often think about, like, bringing it back to race a little more. I think about Lupita Nyong'o, who's a beautiful Kenyan actress who's really dark skin. She talks in one of her TED Talks about how she would eat sugar cubes every morning so that she would, or every night before she went to bed, hoping that she would wake up lighter skinned in the morning. So she's talking about colorism and how society really favors lighter, brighter skin. And she says, you know, her mom would come to her and say, you're beautiful just the way you are. I love you. And she says, you know, of course my mom would say that. She's my mom. She's supposed to say that. But she wasn't hearing it from the rest of the world and society. So I think that about adoption too, and the language of, like, we chose you. Like, adoptees hear that of, like, of course you want me. You're my parents. You're supposed to think that. You're supposed to think I'm beautiful. But it doesn't have the same punch as it would if society was saying that too, which we're not. Society is communicating that transracial adoption is unique, we get a lot of microaggressions and comments that this is unusual, that you are interesting and exotic. And so the fact that our parents tell us well-intentioned, kind words, we chose you, we wanted you, we worked a long time to get you, we love the skin color that you have, really is negated because society pressures are so strong on the other end.
So you get one message at home and another message in the outside world. So what should parents say, Angela, if there's anything they can say?
I think it's less a matter of what they say. You know, it's continuing to say, you know, kind things that you would say to your child to help them in all aspects of their identity. And it's more about putting other people in place to do those parenting duties that you cannot do as a white person. One example I think of is, like, my dad doesn't play piano. And so he didn't teach me how to play piano. He hired a piano teacher so that I could learn how to play. And I think that that example is pertinent when we talk about race, that hearing from your white parents about how to be a black person in society, especially when we have policing the way it is, that hearing it from your white parents doesn't sound the same and isn't as impactful as it is to hear it from someone who looks like you and someone who, you know, has experienced racism.
So, Kelly, what do you think about that? Because you work with parents, and it's really interesting to hear Angela say, you know, her dad hired a piano teacher because he didn't know how to play the piano. So why not, quote unquote, hire someone who can help your child, you know, work through all the junk you get on the playground and stuff you get in the halls of the high school?
I really appreciate what was just said. I do this exercise in the seminar where I ask the parents to draw a map of the people in their village, their community, their family, their lives. And later on in the afternoon, I ask them to think of the child and the color that they're adopting of, and to look at that map then and look at other people within their current village who will share that racial makeup as the child they're bringing into the village. And almost always, they're able to circle maybe one person in the entire picture that will share the same race as the child bringing in. And it's kind of an eye-opener of you have got to expand your village of people that look like your child so that your child has adult mentors and role models. And I don't agree with hiring them. I think it's developing natural.
I think we're using
natural,
that in air quotes. Exactly. But yeah, sort of bringing them into your circle.
It's developing those relationships so that parents have somebody to call when they need to.
More on transracial adoptions in just a moment. So much more to talk about. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Listen to NHPR for reporting that you trust and for award-winning journalism that's available to everyone in your community. I'm Rick Yanley, host of Morning Edition, and when you donate to NHPR today, you can extend your generosity by giving meals to the New Hampshire Food Bank. Contribute $10 a month and pay forward your thank you gift. Instead of choosing a mug or a t-shirt, choose to give 10 meals to the food bank. Give today and pay it forward at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, transracial adoption, or adoption outside of one's own race or ethnic group, it continues to grow in the U.S., and we're asking how families here in New Hampshire can engage in meaningful conversations about identity, culture, and race. Let's hear from you. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. By the way, as the year 2018 comes to a close, we also want your vote on our top shows of the year. The Exchange team has chosen 10 shows that we loved, and we're asking you to vote on 5. And then we'll air the top vote getters during the holiday week. So take our survey. Again, we'd love for you to participate. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Our guests for the hour are Angie Lane. As we said earlier, she was adopted as an infant from South Korea. She grew up in New Hampshire. Kelly Smith is with us, longtime social worker for foster and adoptive families in the state, specializing in attachment, trauma, and loss. And joining us from Washington State is Angela Tucker. She's an African-American who was adopted by white parents as a baby. Today, she runs the website The Adopted Life. It features conversations with other adult transracial adoptees and Angela's documentary called Closure, which is about the story of her search for her birth parents. One more time, that number for you to join our conversation is 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, we've been talking about, you know, the well-intentioned messages that transracial adoptees get at home, but then you go out in the real world and you're not really sure how to navigate it. Angela told us earlier that, you know, her parents tried to put her in contact with other African-Americans because that was helpful. What do you think about that, Angie Lane?
When I heard that, I was just thinking how wonderful that would have been, just because...
For you.
For me. And also, just I completely agree, as far as society and media went, I had very limited ideas of what it meant to be Asian. And
you grew up in Concord, right?
Right outside of Concord, yeah. In Pembroke. And so it was really hard to figure out my racial identity. And also, when you're growing up, you're just trying to fit in and you don't want to stand out. And all I did physically was stand out from my peers. And so it would have been helpful if there was someone in real life that I could meet, because I really only had, you know, media. And I think my parents, you know, had given me different items and magazines that they had gotten from
books with Asian girls in them.
And so for me, I just had a very specific idea of what it meant to be Asian. And most of that came from media, which is probably never a great thing for anybody to have. You know, the Barbies that were available, the only Asian or Barbie was the international special edition Barbie dressed in like the traditional Korean wear. And so people were really well intentioned and like trying to get me those things. But all I understood was, okay, so
I'm even more different. My Barbie has different clothes.
And, you know, Connie Chung was the only Asian person on television. And she was frankly stereotypical, smart. Like, I knew that Asians were supposed to be smart and, you know, good with technology. You know, the movies were very stereotypical, like, you know, Breakfast at Tiffany's or 16 Candles. They were people to be made fun of, people to be, you know, it was funny. It was always the funny character, the sidekick. And, you know, people told me I spoke good English. And that's really confusing when you're a child and even growing up.
And you're thinking, of course I speak good English. I grew up in Pembroke, New Hampshire.
And I don't speak any other language. So it was, for me, unfortunately, it, you know, it was negative. It was a negative thing. And so when you're a child just trying to form who you are and figuring out, you know, what you are and taking all these cues, all I knew was that, you know, I was different and that wasn't necessarily a good thing at all. And so, and I was expected to be smart. I was, and, you know, in first grade, I remember I was using chopsticks to pick up popcorn because it was just like this one. And I was just like, I guess I'm a bad Asian. I don't know how to use
chopsticks. I can't pick up popcorn with chopsticks.
And so, and those were the expectations that other kids had of me too. And they weren't necessarily, they weren't coming from a bad place. We're in first grade. And so, but for me, I'm like, why don't I know another language? Why don't I know karate? I mean, and now I understand those things are kind of outrageous anyway. And so, but it was all about me not fitting in as in a white community, but also not fitting in as an Asian person. So.
Wow. Angela, can you talk about that too? Just kind of the, you know, getting one message at home, you're fabulous, you're beautiful, whatever, going out into the world and having these cultural expectations placed on you. Like, Angie was expected to be smart. She was expected to know how to use chopsticks. She was expected to speak Chinese or Korean or whatever. Did that happen to you, Angie? And how... Excuse me, Angela, and how did your family help or not help you work through that?
I remember being chosen for a basketball team for, like, varsity before even trying out.
Wow, just because you were black.
Yeah. And so certainly we are only going, like, stereotypes exist for a reason. And as a young child, you only know to fulfill the stereotypes that have been placed around you because, like Angie said, you want to fit in and you think that's what you're supposed to be. And if you don't see examples, like, this is where representation really matters. If I don't see black people that are also doctors and they're at the grocery store, they're teachers, they're not just teaching African American studies, but they're also teaching English class or math or whatever else, then you're going to fulfill the prophecy of stereotypes. And so I in my home, it was about normalizing the fact that, you know, I, as a black youth or as I was growing up, loved classical music. And there are other people in this country that are black who also play classical piano or listen to country music. You know, it was trying to expand my horizons. That was really helpful for me to know that I didn't have to be who others thought I needed to be.
That must be really hard though, Angela, huh? Especially when you're young.
It's really difficult. And I think it was helpful for me to have other siblings who were other races as well. So my parents were not in the majority in our home. Of course, they were in the positions of power. They're our parents. But it wasn't just me, the black kid in our family, but I have siblings who are Laotian and just different races. And we talked about all of that. And we also talked about, I think there is a comfort in understanding the role of white supremacy within transracial adoption. And I appreciate Judith's comment that, there are, transracial adoption is not synonymous with white parents with kids of color. However, it is the norm. And the reason she has to bring it up is because of white supremacy. And in my home, it was nice for me to be able to ask, like, why didn't any black families want to adopt me? And there are really real reasons around that I was able to learn at a young age. And that kind of conversation really helped me understand the national landscape of race and the role it plays in our culture. So that I didn't feel like such an anomaly, but I understood like how this worked within the greater picture. I think it's really important for white parents to understand that in 1972, the National Association of Black Social Workers called transracial adoption cultural genocide. And if white parents aren't willing to state that truth, then that's a problem. You got to be able to have that conversation because it's the truth of our history.
You know, you had, so it sounds like you had a couple siblings, Angela, of different races. Angie, you have two brothers who are biological from your parents.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
So that probably would have been nice for you, right? To have somebody else who could kind of relate to what you were going through.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's a huge benefit of having any other person of color in your family or in your sphere. You know, for me, my brothers were 6 and 8 years older than me and very much look like my father. And I always get told how much they look like Elaine. And obviously, I don't look like Elaine compared to them. And so as a child, those are just like the subtle things that are being said around me with no negative intention from my parents or my family. But it reiterated that I was different.
Do you want to jump in, Kelly Smith, on some of the things that we're hearing from Angela and Angie?
Sure. I think their stories are so important, and I'm glad we're having the discussion today. One of the things I think is so important, and we've spoken to it already, is we have to prepare our kids to be able to manage peers on the playground and in the locker room at school. And I think one of the ways that happens is that families talk about this and give their children who are of color a different language and the words to say. And I often talk about in this class that we go to the grocery store or the post office or the bank, and the person working there will say things to a transracial family. Oh, is that kid really yours? Or where is he from? Or where did you get him? And often white couples don't know how to handle the grocery store lady. So in the class, we talk about how do you be an ambassador for your family, how you be an ambassador for your child, how do you give language to the grocery store lady, because your little kid is standing there watching. And as they go to school, they will then have language of what to say to someone on the playground who says, is that really your mom, or why don't you look like her, or things like that. So we can't just love the kids up and, as we've already heard this morning, talk about it in the house. We've got to prepare the kids for when they're out of the house on the playground of what to say. And I think that happens by way of specific language, but also what do we do with the grocery store lady when she approaches us about our family of color.
Lots of emails coming in. And again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So Courtney sent us a note from Dover. She says, my husband and I brought our son home from Ethiopia in May. Wow, Courtney. We went through Kelly's adoption class and then met with her again before we traveled. While preparing to bring our son home, we tried to do lots of reading about transracial adoption, but we really valued our time meeting with Kelly. She helped us consider things that we had yet to think about. We are so very thankful for her time, encouragement, and expertise. So there's a shout out for you, Kelly. Courtney says, the conversation around transracial adoption will continually be a focus for us as we raise our son here in New Hampshire. And Kelly, just real quick to you, you know, we talked earlier about how it's not always white families doing transracial adoptions, but it most of the time is. We talked about some of the difficulties of expanding your circle, you know, bringing in other people into your life who look like your child. That's especially tough in New Hampshire, isn't it, Kelly? We're a 94% white state.
It is, but it takes intention. And there are so many adoptive families out there who have adopted children of a different race. So even if it's just connecting up with other transracially adopted families, and everyone's adoption agency can connect them to other families. So I think it's both. It's connecting with other adoptive families, but also connecting with other adoptive families who have adopted transracially. There's your community right there.
And you said again that you've been working in this field for 30 years, and you have seen transracial adoptions continuing to grow steadily here in the state.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Courtney, thank you for that email. We've got a couple more emails coming in, but I did want to get your thoughts too, Angela, on the idea that, you know, you got to widen your circle. It sounds like your parents did a pretty good job with that, but I'm not sure what the demographics of Washington State are.
It's pretty white out here. And they did a good job. Bellingham, Washington was predominantly white, a little bit of a college town. So when college was in session, it changed a little bit. But as an adult, and this happens a lot for transracial adoptees, that college is a time when people are seeking to learn more about their identity in general. I think that was about the time when my circle really expanded to include transracial adoptees, not just Black people, because the experience is so different. And I am working right now to create a mentorship program where it's not just transracial adopted kiddos. It's also same race adopted kids, but that I'm really hopeful that our next generation of transracial adoptees can be surrounded by other transracial adoptees. And so some of the work I'm doing now is to help create that, as opposed to just being surrounded by other transracial adoptive families, which is great. But there are conversations that transracial adoptees need to have with one another and really feel comfortable and safe doing that. And so it's really important that those relationships also are cultivated.
What kinds of conversations, Angela? That's really interesting.
It's difficult to tell your parents things like we talked about earlier. It's difficult to say to your parents, like, I just don't feel like I fit in, especially when your parents really are doing all that they can. But to talk to another transracial adoptee, it's like a breath of fresh air because they just get it. There isn't a need to give qualifiers at the beginning, like, I'm so grateful I'm here. My parents are so wonderful. Like, you don't have to do that. Whereas when you're talking to other people who are just learning about transracial adoption or your parents, you really feel like you have to do that first. Thank you for putting me in this heritage camp in the summer. I really appreciate it. But I still feel isolated in my school. Like, it's really hard to say that. But
it's the preamble. Yeah.
You don't have to give that preamble. And that is like a lift of emotional weight. It's emotional weight that doesn't have to go into what you actually want to say. Like, you can just go into it and have people who get it. It's less of a conversation of like what is good or bad, but it's just what is. And being able to say that is so refreshing.
You know, Angela, you can't see her, but Angie is just nodding vigorously. What do you think, Angie?
You know, it's really crazy. Just as she was talking, I realized, I think, Angela, even though we're not meeting in the same room, you're probably the first transracial adoptee I've ever spoken to.
Really?
Kind of.
Wow.
So it's so strange. I feel like you're saying things that have been in my head for like 40 years now. Just because it's true. Like, every time you talk to someone else, you have to, I mean, I feel guilty if I don't say, because I absolutely love and adore my parents. And so you feel this guilt, like, I don't want to come off as ungrateful or that I want a different life. It's just, there's no one that can possibly really understand what it feels like. And frankly, in the same way, I've only ever, you know, I don't have a huge circle of people of color of my own in my friend group. So, and it's really about geography for me. But even having those conversations for the first time as an adult and meeting people and sharing experiences was so huge for me. So even just hearing Angela talk like that, I'm like, wow, that's exactly how I've been feeling all my life. And so,
well, good thing you came to join us today, Angie.
It is. It's clandestine. But no, it's really wonderful. And you can't underestimate how valuable that is to somebody to hear that, you know, that you're not alone.
So. Well, I want to let you, Angie, and other people, transracial adoptees who might be listening today, that on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, we have links to Angela's website, and she's done so much writing and work around this issue. So there's a resource for people, even if you don't have a lot of transracial adoptees in your own geographic area. Sounds like there's a lot of resources online from all the work that Angela has done. We will talk a lot more in just a moment, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, transracial adoptions. Let's hear from you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, with your stories, questions, and comments. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Exchange listeners, by the way, as 2018 comes to a close, we want your vote on our top shows of the year. The Exchange team has chosen 10 that we loved, but we'd love for you to vote on 5 that you like the best, and then we'll air them during the holiday week. So check out our survey at nhpr.org/exchange. Well, all of you, lots more to talk about and lots of comments from our listeners. Johanna writes us from Nashua. My husband's sister was adopted from Korea at 6 months. When we were considering adoption, we asked her if she was comfortable with us adopting outside the U.S. She struggled deeply, and we figured she would know better than anyone whether we were up to handling all the issues that came up. Johanna, thank you very much for the email. And, you know, Angela, you mentioned earlier in the show that your parents, in an effort to widen your circle of people who looked like you, sent you to a heritage camp. I have to say that caught my interest. What is a heritage camp?
I didn't go to heritage camps as a youth, but I speak at them now.
Okay.
So there are a handful of camps specifically for transracial adoptive families. Some of the camps are kind of parsed out by race or ethnicity, and others are more just for transracial families in general. In fact, we PACT, which is an organization in California, had a camp in Vermont on the East Coast last summer that was interesting in the sense that the town it was held in was had a lot of racist views and wasn't prepared for this huge influx of seeing Black kids in their neighborhood. But in general, the camps provide a space for just to have these types of conversations, to bring in speakers, to hear from other adoptees who've experienced this. And most importantly, at many of these camps, the kids get to have counselors who are like them, that are also transracial adoptees. So for a week, for many of these camps, it's a week long, they get to have all of these conversations as they are also simply having fun and playing. And so it's like, it's affirmation that this is one of your many identities, and people can do it in this comforting space. White adoptive parents and other adoptive parents too, but they also get the opportunity to come together and have kind of sessions and seminars and trainings on how to make sure that they are helping their child instill a healthy sense of identity and race.
Well, and I'm imagining, Kelly, it's a continuum, because when you're preparing for adoption, as Johanna and her husband were, that's one thing to have a baby and, you know, a toddler. It's another thing to have an elementary school kid, and then in middle school, oh my goodness, I mean, I don't want to be different in middle school, you know. And then in high school, you start to think about, who am I? So it's a continuum. It isn't just do the classes, you know, before you have this baby.
Absolutely. It's a lifelong journey. As an adoptee, it's a lifelong journey. And then you add race on top of it. It's absolutely a lifelong journey, like it is for all of us, in terms of figuring out our identity and who we are and where we come from and what do we want to be when we grow up and what do we want to be when we're old. We had a young woman come live with us at age 18. She was adopted from Ethiopia younger in life. And that adoption did not work out. So she came to live with us. And I learned a lot from her, because that day we became a biracial family with her joining us. And we live in Hopkinton, a very Caucasian community. And she was from Ethiopia. And she was a junior in high school. And she felt so out of place that she finished 2 years of high school in 1 year. And then she basically ran to Boston and went to a couple colleges down there in Suffolk and things like that, because she just needed to be in the city. And she taught me a lot. And we, when we go to the movie theater, she would look for other people that look like her. I'd look for the best seat on the aisle. We'd go to the mall. I'd look for the sale rack. She'd look for people that looked like her. So she clearly has spent a lifelong journey trying to identify and figure out who she is.
Well, and it's interesting that you say she ran to Boston as soon as she could. Angela, did you ever live somewhere else besides Washington State? You told us earlier that it's a very white area. Did you ever have a desire to live in a more diverse area?
It's a great question. I bounced around a little bit, moved to California for school, but ultimately came back, and now I'm in Seattle. But I echo the thoughts about adoption being a lifelong experience for adoptees. And one, post-adoption services is kind of a new burgeoning field that we are finally starting to recognize that adoption doesn't just, once an adoption is finalized, that everything is good and off you go. Like, actually, more services are needed. In one way for me that's played out is having to reconcile my choice to marry a white man and to choose to live in a predominantly white neighborhood in Seattle, that this has been a point of contention and really kind of difficult for me to grapple with as a Black woman. And what's been helpful is to really understand and to assimilate the fact that I feel very comfortable in white spaces. And it varies. My feelings around it vary. Sometimes I feel very embarrassed about that. But I certainly think back to the time when I went to Tennessee, met my birth parents, and was in predominantly black spaces, and how uncomfortable I felt in those areas, and how this is an area where I think, you know, I'm choosing to share this aspect of my story to try to shine a light on the importance of surrounding your kids with people who look like them, because, you know, a result is something like myself, where I'm happy to live in the space I do, but it definitely is unique. And it means that many conversations continue in my adulthood about, you know, why do you live here? And I don't understand where you came from, and how did this work? So I'm even walking around my neighborhood, I'm having to talk about the fact that I was adopted and raised in Bellingham, and that's why I feel comfortable here in this area.
Do you ever get tired of answering questions, questions like that?
I think it's a duty. You know, I grew up understanding that we all have a power, and as transracial families, I think you are also signing up to educate, and that is an unfortunate ramification of our society. And so I appreciate the opportunities to educate, but certainly it is a tall order to always have to be that spokesperson. I am working hard to help families now not have to be in that place, because we want our kids to be able to just grow up and be who they want to be and not have to represent transracial adoption. But for me, I have taken it on as a big part of my identity, and I've enjoyed that for the sake of our next generation.
Right. Yeah, it's tiring, though, to always be a diplomat.
Definitely.
Maybe I just want to, you know, buy some socks, and I don't need to be, you know, get some tape and socks and go home. Angie, I'm curious, because some of the stuff that Angela is saying reminds me of something that you said in an interview with Jimmy Gutierrez that actually didn't get on the air. But you said, and I'm quoting here, you sometimes feel like a, quote, fraud, that someone will say to you, oh, it's so cool, you're a woman of color running a major arts organization. And you feel like saying, oh, but I'm not really a person of color.
I did.
I thought that was so interesting.
It is. I feel like I'm not legitimately Korean, and I'm not legitimately American in some ways, just because I think I struggle with the idea that, you know, living in a very predominantly white community, I obviously stand out. And so I feel unprepared sometimes when people expect me to speak for all people of color, or speak it in a point of view that is just very Korean. And so for me, it's I hate saying it, but I use that example. Like, I feel like a knockoff handbag sometimes. Like, I have, you know, like, people see me and expect certain things from me, or have expectations about what my life is or what my background is. And sometimes it's a pleasant surprise, or sometimes it's a misunderstanding, but there is that pressure to be that spokesperson for every person of color, or
and you're, you know, thinking, I'm really not that person.
Yeah, I mean, I have a unique point of view, definitely, but I think it's a lot of pressure. I think that for me, I'm learning to what that means, and similar to Angela, I think I've really kind of taken up that idea of trying to educate people. But sometimes I'm just like you said, I don't really want to talk about my personal background daily basis.
Right. Yeah. Right. I just pick up the bottle of aspirin and go home. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So as we close out, Kelly, I did want to ask you, you know, Angela said earlier, and you said earlier, that adoption is a parenting in general is a lifelong process. And just because you take all those Kelly Smith classes when you're getting ready to invite to welcome that baby into your home, how do you think transracial adoptions have changed in terms of helping parents become more aware, helping the kids, you know, navigate this sort of dual identity that Angie and Angela have talked about? Have we gotten more savvy about this? I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
I think, boy, that's a hard one. I think we've gotten maybe a little more savvy, but we have so much more work to do. I think it's continuing to have the conversations and to be open about it and not be embarrassed. And this is who I am, and this is who my family is, and this is what I'm struggling with, and this is what I'm excited about. We just need to keep talking about it.
What do you mean, more conversations? I mean, you gave us a hint, but give us a little bit more there.
You know, I call it the old days. So 30 years ago when we did adoptions, we just didn't talk about this stuff. You just adopt them, love them up, and everything's going to be fine. And maybe you talk about it in the family a little bit, but as soon as you leave that house, you wouldn't talk about it. You wouldn't talk about adoption, not to mention race. So I think we're talking about it more. I think people are more proud to say they're an adoptive family. I think individuals are more proud to say, I'm an adoptee. So I think those conversations, like today, need to just keep happening.
Angela, last words from you on that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that I, as an adoptee, am quick to say that I'm proud. But I do think that things have changed in the sense that adoptee voices are becoming heard, normalized, and believed, that no longer are we only hearing from so-called angry adoptees or grateful adoptees, which is kind of the two camps that many people put us in. But there is a myriad of voices that parents are listening to, and that they're really making changes based on the lived experiences from adopted people. And that is really positive.
Well, Angela, thank you very much again for getting up early there in the West Coast and for just sharing your stories and ideas with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Angela Tucker. Again, she runs the website The Adopted Life, and you should check it out on our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Kelly Smith, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Kelly Smith, longtime social worker for foster and adoptive families here in New Hampshire. And Angie Lane, it was really great to see you too. Thank you for being here.
No, thank you.
Angie Lane, as she told us, she was adopted as a baby from South Korea. Today, she's executive director of Red River Theaters in Concord. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.